Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Monday, September 13th. On Monday, September 13th, a day when it seems like everybody is suing everybody, after a weekend when many Americans drop politics as usual to pay tribute to the victims and heroes of 9/11, we're instantly back to business as usual. If the response to 3,000 Americans killed in the attacks became contentious, so too in spades is the response to 660,000 Americans dying in a year and a half from the coronavirus, including in the last few weeks more than 1,500 people a day. That's another 9/11 every 2 days, almost all of them unvaccinated. But as the Biden administration is suing Texas over the state's new ban on almost all abortions, Texas and other Republican-led states say they're planning to sue Biden over vaccine mandates, the right to health care and the right to endanger others by not getting health care. Both seem headed out of the hands of public health officials and politicians and into the hands of the lawyers. When Biden was asked about the possibility of being sued over a supposed right to not get vaccinated, he said this, which begins with the words, "Have at it."
Have at it. Look, I am so disappointed that particularly some Republican governors have been so cavalier with the health of these kids, so cavalier with the health of their communities. This is we're playing for real here. This isn't a game.
With me now is the perfect person to talk about this confluence of politics and law, Emily Bazelon, New York Times Magazine writer, Slate Political Gabfest weekly podcast team member, and the Truman Capote Fellow at the Yale University Law School. And maybe it all comes together in one of Emily's pieces for The Times recently called How the Pandemic Changed Abortion Access. Emily, thanks for starting your week with us. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you so much for having me. So glad to be here.
Can you start by laying out a little bit of what was in the president's new plan to fight the Delta variant that the Republican governors might challenge, not just on policy grounds, but on constitutional grounds?
Well, you know, the big step that President Biden is taking here is to require vaccination for federal workers and also for workers at companies that have 100 employees or more. And so this could cover as much as 2/3 of the American workforce. It's a big, broad vaccine mandate of a kind that I don't think we've seen at a federal level in American history before. And so inevitably, because vaccines and particularly vaccine mandates have become so polarizing in the United States, we are going to see legal challenges to this federal order.
The country has other vaccine mandates. You can't send your kids to school almost anywhere without polio and pertussis and hepatitis and meningitis and measles, mumps, rubella vaccines and others. Have these been tested in court?
Yeah, some of them have been challenged and they've been upheld. You know, many states make exemptions on religious bases and certainly on medical bases for people who aren't recommended to take vaccines. And there's been litigation about how broad those kinds of exemptions can be. You know, what is different, I think, is the point you made. We are used to vaccine mandates coming through schools. Before you get to go to school, you have to get these vaccines. And so it's been imposed on kids and on families. And there's been, you know, some controversy about it because there is this anti-vaccination movement in the United States. But it has such a long history that it has also mostly been accepted. What's different this time, of course, is that it's coming, the mandate is coming through adults in the workplace because, you know, kids under the age of 12 aren't even eligible to get the vaccine.
Yeah, I don't even like the term vaccine mandate. I'm curious if you have an opinion about this. I mean, they're not sending doctors and nurses and pharmacists to people's homes and forcing needles into their arms. They're saying you have a right to choose not to get vaccinated, you do have that right. But then society has a right to protect itself from the risk you pose to others by making that choice. So to me, it's not exactly a vaccine mandate. Maybe our listeners can suggest a more accurate term, but how much would that be the government's defense? Or what do you think about the phrase vaccine mandate?
Well, I think you're right to kind of change how we are framing this in terms of choice. And, you know, one important point to make is that if you don't get vaccinated under this rule, then you are tested weekly. So that's another option. And, you know, people who oppose requiring vaccines in some kind of form or fashion, and we can talk about the language too, they say this is about their medical freedom. But of course, I think the point you're making is that other people have the freedom to be in the workplace safely. And, you know, the reason in the past that courts have given the government, state, federal government, broad power to protect public health is that contagious diseases affect everyone's behavior, affects everyone else. It's not just about your own personal freedom. It's also about the way in which you're impacting other people.
There is at least one Supreme Court precedent on vaccine mandates, isn't there?
Yes, there is. Well, there's a really important precedent. It's called Jacobson versus Massachusetts. It was decided by the Supreme Court in 1905. I was actually just looking at a piece that John Witt, who's a law professor at Yale, wrote about this whole issue a whole year ago. And what happened in that case was that Cambridge, Massachusetts wanted to do a mandatory vaccine program to slow the outbreak of smallpox. And what the court did was to say, okay, you know, is this a necessary step? Is the government doing this vaccine mandate in an arbitrary and unreasonable manner? And so essentially what you see here is the court and courts generally upholding the actions of health authorities, but insisting, as John says, that regulation bear a rational relationship to an actual health imperative. And, you know, that's the same kind of balancing test you would expect the courts to use this time around as well.
Is the Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, Coney Barrett court likely to thumb their noses at this precedent, as they might also do to Roe versus Wade, which we'll get to next?
I mean, that is really the huge question. I think the Supreme Court is the wild card here. What we've seen so far in COVID-related litigation is that the court has been very protective of religious liberties. So there were churches that challenged public health rules in California and New York, and they won. Now, I would argue that those public health rules were not as clearly unarbitrary, et cetera, as this new Biden order. And this kind of gets into the weeds. But, you know, what the churches argued was that they were being treated somewhat differently from other institutions that were open. And there were kinds of questions about whether the percentage capacity rules the local public health authorities had chosen were the correct ones. Anyway, I don't want to get too far into the weeds. I would argue that this what Biden is doing has a strong basis, and this 1905 precedent is going to be, should be, hugely influential even on these current justices.
What about the question, Emily, staying on the Biden rules, of whether Biden as president can do this through an executive order or a group of them rather than get a law passed by Congress? Is he making a claim to executive authority here that's being challenged as dictatorial?
Yes, he's making a claim to federal authority. He's doing so under the rules for occupational safety and health, right? So we have a whole agency, OSHA, that has lots and lots of workplace rules. And so what Biden is saying is, like, this is necessary to keep American workers safe in their workplaces, the same as, like, various other rules. And the federal government routinely imposes conditions on employers to protect workers' safety. So that is going to be the argument the government is making, that this is really a very routine kind of practice. And yes, people are going to argue that it's unconstitutional, that it supersedes the powers of the president. You know, I would say that for most of American history, when you look at the court precedents, it looks like President Biden is on safe ground. And again, the question will be whether this Supreme Court agrees.
I'm so glad you brought up workers, because I think people forget the sort of worker-to-worker element of this and the workers' rights element of this. You know, there's a New York City corollary, I think, from when Mayor Michael Bloomberg imposed the no smoking in restaurants and other public places rule. And one of the arguments against that by people who didn't like that was, well, if you don't want to be in a restaurant where people are smoking, you can go to a restaurant where voluntarily they impose a no smoking rule. But that only focused on the patrons, because the no smoking rule, as much as anything, probably more than anything, from Mayor Bloomberg's standpoint, was to protect the workers who have no choice but to be there if they want to be employed in the restaurants in New York City if they're working in that sector. And so there is a parallel to that here.
Yes, I think it's really important that you brought it up. I teach in university, and I've been teaching in a classroom where the students are required to be vaccinated and they're required to wear masks. And as a result, I think, well, I feel comfortable being there. I think a lot of faculty members are also feeling okay about the arrangement. But at universities where there are not those rules, you have staff members, the people in the dining halls. There are a lot of public-facing workers in the world who are at risk from people who are not vaccinated. And it is also, of course, this deep irony that it's the people who are not vaccinated who are much, much more at risk of hospitalization and death. And the CDC released data showing that, you know, again last week. So I think what you're talking about are the responsibilities we all have to each other and the broader society, and then in these particular social compacts we make in the workplace.
So far, the Republican governors are only saying they're planning to sue the Biden administration. Could it be that they're just playing politics by bluffing because they know the legal precedents are strong and they'll lose, but they won't really go to court? They're just putting political pressure on Biden by saying they will?
I mean, that's an interesting question. I would still think that somebody will sue, right? I mean, Republican governors and attorneys general have not been shy about suing Democratic administrations. The lawsuit in itself becomes a kind of political act. I would expect somebody to follow through, even if they are on weak legal ground, as a kind of, you know, symbolic political matter. But we'll see.
Let's talk about the Justice Department suing Texas over its ban on abortions. That's being described as a ban after 6 weeks. I think that one, too, is a misnomer, but we'll get to that. CNN calls the lawsuit a Hail Mary pass, meaning it's a long shot. What's the Justice Department's case?
The Justice Department says that since Roe versus Wade is on the books, Texas's law is unconstitutional, and that the federal government, because it protects the Constitution, has what's called an argument under the Supremacy Clause that Texas's law should fall. And so the idea here is that when you have federal law, in this case, Roe versus Wade from the courts and the Constitution, that is supreme. Or another way to put it is that preempts the states from making a contradictory law. So that's the first part of the claim. It's kind of a broad one about federal constitutional power. And then there's a kind of interesting, more technical argument about something called intergovernmental immunity that I had to go look up when I saw that term. And what that involves is the idea that there are federal workers who, based on federal law, are supposed to help people who seek abortions get them, since that's their constitutional right. So the Job Corps federal program in Texas, the Office of Refugee Resettlement, and there are other examples of people who, as federal employees, their work can include transporting people to get abortions. And this Texas law is conflicting with their federal duties. And so that's the argument the Justice Department is making. And I think the big question is whether what kind of relief could really come through the suit. The Justice Department says they want a judgment saying this law should be enjoined from going into effect and that no one can sue to enforce it. And that's the key part, because what the Texas law does is put the hands of enforcing this ban in private hands. Anyone can sue somebody who aids and abets an abortion. And so the Justice Department is trying to block that through this action.
And because this is being nicknamed a bounty hunter law, these private individuals can sue somebody over having an abortion or helping somebody have an abortion and make money that way?
Yes, indeed. Yeah, the bounties are $10,000 a pop, and you get your legal fees paid if you win, but you don't have to pay the other side's legal fees if you lose. So that's the kind of enticement in the law for all kinds of lawsuits, very sort of broad liability. And the technical kind of question this law has raised is, who do you sue to stop enforcement? And so the Justice Department is saying, we, the federal government, are suing the state of Texas to prevent this law from going into effect.
Is that unique, that bounty hunter provision, or do other criminal laws have that element?
So in some civil rights contexts, we have people privately who can sue as part of enforcement. So, for example, the American with Disabilities Act. If there's a violation of the ADA, like there are no, you know, wheelchair ramps in a building, the government can sue, but so can somebody who is affected by that law, who can't get into the building. The difference here is that Texas has said that anybody can sue, like really anybody, not even just any Texan. So you don't have to be affected in any way. And that's a different kind of bounty hunting, I think.
Like if I'm an individual in a wheelchair and a place doesn't have ramps that I can get into, place I need to get into, I could sue as an individual. But some, let's say, person not in a wheelchair can't sue just to make money over that.
Exactly. It's the difference between vindicating your own rights and vindicating someone else's rights. Now, of course, people who oppose abortion would say, well, you know, the fetus, the, in their words, the baby can't sue. And so you have to allow someone else to step in. But that's the kind of the difference, the conceptual difference still stands.
Joanne in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Joanne.
Oh, hi. Yes, I have a similar comment to your last caller, in that it, rather than say vaccine mandate, you say, okay, here is what you as an unvaccinated person can and cannot do. And if those, you know, barriers are strong enough, it will encourage people to get vaccinated because they want to do the things they want to do.
Joanne, thank you very much. So, Emily, I like vaccine ultimatum for how accurate it is. It strikes me as accurate. I don't know if it's politically any less polarizing than vaccine mandate.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that's interesting about it, too, is an ultimatum is something that often you impose when you don't have any other choices, right? You're sort of like at your wit's end. And, you know, President Biden took a while to get here. I mean, a few months ago, he was basically saying mandates are not the way to go. And the federal government was really hoping to persuade people to take the vaccine. But now we're stuck. We have, you know, as everybody knows, this very contagious variant of Delta running around, making people super sick. And, you know, the idea that lots of people were persuadable is just does not seem, unfortunately, to be the case.
Texas and other Republican-led states are standing on the principle of individual liberty, right? Being pro-choice when it comes to coronavirus health care, but anti-choice, anti-individual liberty when it comes to reproductive choice. And I guess we could say vice versa about the other side. Could anyone make a constitutional consistency case from either vantage point?
I mean, I think then you get into this question of what the standards are that the courts would impose, right? So in the vaccine context, if the Supreme Court sticks with the court's traditional jurisprudence on public health measures, you expect them to use a test that's pretty deferential to the government, right? Like, is there a rational basis for this regulation? In the context of abortion, because it's a protected constitutional right, as long as that's the case, the courts have a higher standard, right? It's not just like, oh, is there some rational basis for restricting abortion rights? It's supposed to be more than that. And the question of how much more and what that standard is very much up for grabs right now. The standard that's still on the books is this idea of an abortion restriction imposing an undue burden on a person seeking it. I mean, the Texas restriction is essentially a complete ban on abortion because many women don't even know that they're pregnant at 6 weeks. And so there's no, it absolutely imposes an undue burden. The question is whether the Supreme Court still cares about that.
Yeah. And what you said about when women know and don't know that they're pregnant, everyone says it's a ban after 6 weeks of pregnancy. But just like vaccine mandate, I think it's a misnomer because isn't it measured from the start of the woman's previous period? So let's say 3 weeks after the start of her period, she gets pregnant. Then the ban would take effect when she's been pregnant for 3 weeks, not 6 weeks. And she might not even know.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, in a news conference when the governor of Texas was talking about that, he seemed to not understand all of these basic basic points about women's health. But yes, that is part of the problem here.
You wrote a piece last month that ties together the pandemic and abortion rights called How the Pandemic Changed Abortion Access. So tell us about that. How do these two different healthcare stories connect?
So I was writing about medical abortion, and this is a regimen of pills that have been proved over and over again to be safe and effective when people take them around the world. And they're an alternative to surgical abortion, which still remains more common in the United States. But in Europe, for example, at this point, there are many, many more abortions performed with pills, and it's a way of doing it very early in the first trimester. It's essentially you induce a miscarriage. That's how the pills work. And during the pandemic, there was a question about whether to continue requiring women who take abortion pills to see a doctor or have some kind of in-person visit, maybe to have an ultrasound to date the pregnancy before the pills. And some blue states suspended this in-person doctor requirement because of the risks of COVID. And so did the United Kingdom. And so researchers were able to do a study looking at tens of thousands of abortions in the UK, in which there was no in-person consultation, no in-person ultrasound, compared with women who had the in-person consultation just a couple months earlier. And the rates for the medical abortions being safe and effective were just as high. And so the reason this is important is it really shows that medical abortion through telehealth, by having some kind of, you know, consultation that is not in person, is very possible, very safe and effective. And that really should change how we think about abortion access, right? Because you don't have to have a clinic. There isn't a medical reason that you need a clinic nearby. You could call a doctor anywhere in the world. The problem is that there are restrictions on these drugs that are still imposed by the FDA, so federal restrictions about who can provide them and how, and who can mail them. And also there are a bunch of states, the red states, that have telemedicine bans for abortion. So I was trying to talk about the kind of medical evidence here versus the legal thicket that still exists.
By the way, here's another good one on an alternative to vaccine mandate from listener Convit on Twitter. Vaccination privileges. I like that one too, because that puts a positive spin on it. You get a vaccine, you get vaccination privileges. You get to work in a public school. You get to eat indoors in a restaurant, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, and right. I mean, I think some local officials, the idea that you need to show some kind of proof of vaccination or a negative test in order to eat in a restaurant or go to the gym, like that is a way in which it's really consistent with the idea of privileges.
Matt in Jersey City on the Texas abortion law. Matt, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hey, Brian. I'm still mystified at how the Texas law even works and like why, I guess just because a bunch of legislators said that it was legal and okay for deputized people, like I think you said, for these bounties. And I think even more crucially, though, is this the beginning of the Roberts era that he's feared, where like, the court, you know, the five justices are clearly just kind of doing what they want rather than sticking with precedent. And I guess is that just part of the political theme we're seeing in general with like the norms collapsing and all the great stuff you guys always talk about on the GabFest?
Emily, a fan of your podcast.
I know. I love that. Thank you so much for listening. So I'm also mystified by this law, and it's not that I haven't worked hard to understand it. I technically understand it. It's just that it should have been prevented from going into effect when you look at the way courts have previously adjudicated abortion restrictions since Roe versus Wade. So what normally happens is a state passes a restriction, it's at odds with Roe versus Wade, and so the courts say it's not going to go into effect while we work this out and hear the case. And the technical reason that didn't happen this time is that because it was all private enforcement and bounty hunters, the Supreme Court acted as if it was a big unsolvable question, who to sue? How do you sue all the bounty hunters? What public official do you sue if the government isn't enforcing it? But, you know, the idea that there's one government official who you sue is kind of a legal fiction to begin with. And the idea that you couldn't substitute some other public official or find some way to allow the suit to go forward was really a big choice the Supreme Court made. And, you know, in answer to your concern about the Roberts Court kind of arbitrarily going its merry way, the Supreme Court's part in this happened through what's called the shadow docket, which is this very cursory process where you don't have full briefing, you don't have argument in front of the court that everybody gets to hear, and the court itself issued a one-paragraph decision. This is not a fully developed set of legal reasons. It doesn't even touch the question of whether Roe versus Wade and abortion access remains a constitutional right. So I think that there were lots of people who are concerned about that.
Emily Bazelon, New York Times Magazine writer, Slate Political Gabfest Weekly podcast team member, and the Truman Capote Fellow at the Yale University Law School. Always great, Emily. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.